Hey, good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. Another week begins. It is Monday morning. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got that coming up. We're going to talk about beloved movies that never made it to number one at the box office. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. We got a Blackhawks Express coming up. And we'll have a visit from Eric Childress, who will be joining us live from Utah at the Sundance Film Festival with exclusive previews of some of the movies that he is seeing at Sundance that we'll see in the coming weeks and months. We always get a great report from Eric. Now, since Eric is in at Sundance right now, Jim Liskowski is going to fill in our regular segment here, the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, which are happening right now. Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more is going to join us as well. And Jim from his Now Playing Network podcasts fills in for Eric. So let's welcome Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
And Jim. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, Nick. It's an honor, as always, to be making a cameo on your show.
Well, it's our pleasure, and we thank you for doing it. Let's first of all talk about your new podcast, Voices and Visions. Jim, tell us about that.
Oh, sure. So I made, a difficult decision to sort of dial back on Directors Club if maybe I was approaching that as like my full-time gig last year. Now I'm sort of going back to part-time simply because I want to focus on writing, teaching, and conducting more interviews, which is essentially what spawned Voices and Visions. It's a website, it's a blog, and it's a podcast dedicated to my interests surrounding music and film. So I'll be posting the occasional audio interview with someone whose work I appreciate or someone I consider to be inspirational. I've interviewed people like Keith Gordon and Matthew Sweet and Alan Moyle, among many others, and I will continue to do so throughout the year. But I'm also going to be writing reviews and doing all sorts of fun stuff there over at Voices and Visions. So people can visit voicesvisions.net. Someone snagged voicesandvisions.net. So simply just type Voices, Visions, no and in that URL. Yeah, so that'll be great if people check that out.
Right. Okay, so it's voicesvision.net, and the Now Playing Network is still going. You can check out nowplayingnetwork.net with a lot of great podcasts available there. All right, cool.
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right, cool. Okay, well, let's first of all, I did not see Triple X, so none of us did. I did, however, when I was at the theater, see a lot of very excited teenagers running into the IMAX theater to see it. So I don't know what that
very
means.
Telling.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Yeah,
there you go. I don't know what why I have like an absolute love for the Fast and Furious movies, but I've got no interest in seeing this. Because I think Vin Diesel's not really the star of the Fast and Furious movies. You know what I mean? Like this, it just has a different feel to it.
Well, I mean, it helps that the first Fast and the Furious reminds us all of the, race car movies, the Roger Corman race car movies of the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's based on that. So, Triple X, you walk into it, there's no, it's not really based on anything except somebody's, dumb teenage adolescent idea.
Yeah. It's like, it's like extreme James Bond.
Right. And it's executed.
Now, from what I understand, everybody comes back. Even Ice Cube shows up in the movie. So, like, they bring back a bunch of people who were in the original. They bring back some people who were in the sequel, except for Asia Argento, which was the only good thing in the original movie, and they don't bring her back. Like, what's the matter with you?
Well, she came to her senses.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know. Is her career on an upswing right now?
No, she's concentrating on directing now. That's what she's doing.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, and her father's insane. So there you go.
Of course.
All right. All right, well, let's get started. Colin.
Yeah.
Tell us about Peter and the Farm. This is a documentary, correct?
Yeah, it's a documentary about a guy named Peter who owns a farm.
Okay.
And in Vermont. He's a guy in his mid-60s. He's had this farm for over 30 years. He's had a few wives. He's got some kids, none of them who he sees anymore. He's an alcoholic and, doesn't know much more than how to do this farm. He's kind of trapped himself there. and he wants to make it better, but to what end? That's the question that keeps coming up, and he's, you know, lived a life of isolation over the past several years. He became disillusioned with the activism and drug taking of his youth, and, you know, now talks of suicide and even tells the filmmakers how he might accomplish it and how they might want to film it.
Jeez.
Yeah. Are you uplifted yet?
Man.
They become part of his life and they interact with him and they even help him, you know, with the farm work. And there are some, you know, visuals in the film that are kind of hard to look at. Any card carrying members of PETA will want to stay away from this film. Yeah, so you got, you know, treatment of animals on top of all of this that you never really want to see. But you know what happens on a farm, but you don't want to see it. Well, this movie doesn't flinch away from any of that. But he's an interesting guy in that he's just got this kind of, I could see why the filmmakers are drawn to him in spite of the fact that, you know, when I describe the movie, you kind of want to blow your brains out just thinking about it.
Yeah.
But there's something magnetic about his personality that just, I can see why any documentary filmmaker would be drawn to him. He's not a totally morose kind of guy. He's actually got a little bit of optimism to him, and he hasn't really, you know, when he's on the farm, he seems content some of the time, and then other times he just like, I hate sheep. God, I hate sheep. You know, it's an interesting little character study about a guy that, you know, you're not sure if he's going to make it to the end of the film, but the movie has a little more optimism than I'm letting on. And there are some sequences that are just absolutely beautiful. The way that when he's going off on, you know, his life and, you know, what's the meaning of it all, the cutaways that these filmmakers do are really just beautiful and gorgeous, and they don't, you know, use music or anything like that to enhance it. It's just I can't really describe it except that it's really a unique kind of documentary character study that is very well done and worth checking out. It's at the Siskel Center right now.
Okay. Wow. All right. That sounds like something.
It is something.
All right. It's at the Siskel Center right now. And it's at the Siskel Center right now. And by the way, it's also available on Amazon.
Yeah.
If people want to watch it on the old Amazon, they can get it. It's available also at the Siskel Center. PETA and the Farm. All right. Well, Jim, why don't you tell us about Things to Come?
Oh, happily. This is the latest film from French director Mia Hansen-Love, whose work I was not too familiar with, but a friend of mine has been a huge supporter of films like Eden and Goodbye First Love that she made. And her latest stars the ubiquitous and immensely talented Isabelle Huppert, who you might remember from Elle last year. And in this, she plays a philosophy teacher with a rather tumultuous domestic life, but still has a fulfilling career as a mentor for her students, and in particular one that has gone on to much success in the world of philosophy, writing his own kind of thesis that was very acclaimed. But for her, she's going through a lot of difficulties. Her publisher wants to stop the pressing of her philosophy textbook, saying it's very dated. Her husband wants a divorce. Her mother is extremely codependent, and her children are all grown and leaving her alone to essentially reevaluate her life. She takes a trip and visits the countryside where her protege and star pupil lives in an anarchist cheese-making collective, which is kind of fun to visit anytime. And she also tries to tend to her mother's fat, housebound cat in a way that is quite delightful. And she also makes one last visit to the family beach house to collect her things and reclaim her sense of normalcy despite having so much difficulty going on. So this is an intelligently made film about an intelligent, resilient woman. And it's also very emotionally engaging without being over the top and, I don't know, too showy, I guess. And it's a really good movie about kind of middle-aged adaptation and how women are very strong and capable of moving forward, even when the circumstances are quite exhausting and complicated. There's no better actress on earth right now to sort of portray this kind of resilience, and the director here shows a lot of empathy for all the characters on screen to where they're all fully dimensional. So this isn't a movie, again, like with huge moments and big revelations, but there's a lot of subtle and sublime interactions between real human characters that I thought was just transcendent. So if you're a fan of Isabelle Huppert, you really should rush out to see her continue an incredible streak of performances. And if you're a fan of films like Living Out Loud or stories where women come to terms with who they are, then I cannot recommend this movie more highly. I love movies about desperation and how people cope with personal drama, and this is a perfect example of how to do this type of dramedy right. I saw this last year at the Chicago International Film Festival, so I did put it and I included it in my top 10 list for 2016, but I have no doubt I would also include it this year. So please support the work of this director and actress because I feel they deserve it.
Okay. Things to Come is at the Music Box, and you can
Absolutely.
Check it out there. Okay. All right, guys, hang on. We got to take a break. And then when we come back, we've got more more movies to review here. And we'll get a visit a little bit later on from Eric Childress live from Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. All right, news is coming up next on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Monday morning. My dad will call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about beloved movies that never hit the top of the box office and much more. We got a Black Hawks Express. Right now, we're in the middle of movie reviews with Colin Suter and Jim Liskowski, who's filling in for Eric, who is in Sundance, who we will be talking to in a little bit, live from Utah, and giving us a preview of the movies that he's seen. So we've got more movies to review here. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook.com/Nick D Show. The best way to stay connected. Let's welcome Colin back. Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello there.
Colin, tell us about Patterson.
All right. Well, this is the latest from Jim Jarmusch. And in it, Adam Driver plays a guy named Patterson. He's a guy who drives a bus and writes poetry on his spare time. He has a daily routine, and this film takes place over the course of a week where we see that routine played out every day. He goes to work, eats dinner with his girlfriend, whom he lives with, and then takes the dog out for a walk and gets a beer at his favorite bar, where he knows the bartender and, a few of its patrons. And during his downtime on the day job, he writes poetry in his notebook. And his girlfriend is always on him about, either saving them on the computer or getting them published someday. She has her own artistic endeavors and ambitions. Oh, and she's played by.
Right. You gonna give it a shot? Give it a shot.
Sure. Golshifteh Farahini.
Right. Okay.
Here we go. she's been in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she has.
She likes to paint and design things in these kind of black and white circles and symmetrical designs, and she paints their house in that way, the interior, not the exterior. And she wants to be a country singer, so she starts taking guitar lessons. And the film is just about their existence together, but also about the role of creating art in a really mundane kind of landscape. And, this is not just a movie about a guy named Patterson, but he lives in Patterson. And Patterson is just, it's not the most exciting city or suburb or whatever it is to live in. And, and Adam Driver's character is not a guy who is prone to any kind of outburst of any way. He is very content with this life, or if he's not, he's doing a very good job of hiding it from everybody and just kind of using poetry to escape from the mundane. But he's just a very nice, likable guy. And that's one of the things about the movie that I think is really interesting, is that you got a movie made up of two artists living together that who never seem to argue that much about anything. Even, you know, one's a little more ambitious than the other, but that never becomes a real, like, hot topic issue or anything for them. And I find that this is a movie that is very much in love with the arts, but without, you know, making it kind of any kind of grand statement about it. It's not like La La Land or anything like that, but it's a very quiet, very lovely film that is, I've never seen a movie so obsessed with putting twins in the background of every, you know, of almost every scene. Not since David Byrne's movie, True Story. And there's some really nice symmetry in the shots. You know, Jim Jarmusch is very, you know, is very interested in symmetry here. Even in the casting, you know, Adam Driver plays a driver named Patterson who lives in Patterson. You know, there's a lot of rhyme in this film. You know, even though the movie's based on a character who likes poetries that don't rhyme. But Jim Jarmusch is making his this kind of quiet little poem himself throughout the film. So this is a really just I don't know what where I'd put this in Jarmusch's you know, where I'd rank this one, but probably highly. I think it's a little too long, but I realize I say that when I'm going to be praising it to an hour and 45 minute comedy next week, but I really like this movie. I think it's really lovely, and I think Driver is wonderful in it.
This is my my second favorite movie, if you guys were listening. It's number two on my top 10 list of 2016. I adore this movie. I love it. By the way, it's not his girlfriend. It's his wife. They're married.
Oh, they are married.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, everything that you mentioned about the movie, about it being beautiful and about creating art, and is just it's just this beautiful, beautiful piece of work about art and about poetry. And just I love all of the scenes in the movie where Driver is writing poetry and it appears on the screen, and the inspiration for it and how it happens. I love the structure of it. The structure of the movie is very Jarmusch. It's just one week in time. This guy does the same thing every day. It varies, and it's interesting that these two people are together, because she's so, in terms of like her creativity, she's so different. And accepts like so many different challenges, and like the idea of her creating her art is different than the way that Patterson creates his art. There are wonderful side characters in this movie. You know, the guys in the bar, that's all great stuff. The guy he checks in with at work every day.
My favorite character.
Oh, it was wonderful. Just beautiful stuff. And the relationship between, you know, Driver and his wife, I think is just beautiful. I adore this movie. I think it's first of all, the acting is superb. It's my favorite performance of the year that Driver, because what Adam Driver was in like four movies, in 2016. He was good in all of them, but this I think is the best performance that he gave all year, and it ranks real high on my Jarmusch list. It's, you know, if you're a fan of Jim Jarmusch, this is like a quintessential Jarmusch movie in every single way. And I do want to mention, you know, that he has encounters with different characters throughout the entire film. It's all told from his point of view. There is a scene in an alley where he meets a teenage girl, and they sit down like on some pallets and they talk about poetry. And that scene, to me, it's my favorite scene in the entire movie. I love the way it's written. It's performed beautifully, and it just is inspiring. And just the fact that here's this guy who's in his like 30s, who's just got this, you know, pretty mundane job in this mundane place, talking to this girl who's got this promise in front of her, and talking on the same level as this teenage girl. It is just such a beautiful literate, beautifully written sequence between these two characters. This movie is poetry to me. It's visual poetry, and it comes to life. I loved every second of it. I really, really adore this movie. And it's, you know, and I'm glad that you mentioned La La Land, because it's the first two movies on my list this year are about that, are about creativity, are about creating and ultimately not giving up. And there's a lot of the Jim Jarmusch humor in it, you know, that really weird aside stuff, that strange stuff that Jarmusch throws in there. It's quirky and strange, like the best of the Jarmusch movies. Every time he comes home, the house looks different. There's more. There's more stuff that's been designed. There's suddenly curtains. That there's this. There's tablecloths. All those little subtle visual things that Jarmusch throws in there make it unique. And like the best of his movies, this is. I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. I love it, and I highly recommend it. Where is it? Where is it playing?
It's playing. I know it's playing at the Landmark Century. And hold on, if I can have right now.
I'm looking at it. It just seems to be. No, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah, Landmark Century. It's at Landmark Century in Chicago. And, Jim, you haven't seen it?
Not yet, but I plan to, because I am a Jarmusch fan, and I've heard nothing but great things. I'll see you soon.
It is a phenomenal movie. Phenomenal.
Can't wait.
Okay, so there you go. That's Patterson, and it's playing at the Landmark Century. Okay, Jim, tell us about The Founder.
Sure. This is the latest from director John Lee Hancock, who brought us The Blind Side. And this tells the story of McDonald's very ambitious tycoon, Ray Kroc, who in the beginning starts out as a plucky, hard-drinking, hard-working, self-helping salesman. He's been working in the restaurant supply trades for years, struggling and disappointing his lonely, society-conscious wife, played by Laura Dern. As doors are slammed in his face and all sorts of drive-ins and fast food joints all over his native Illinois and elsewhere, he ventures out west and discovers a successful hamburger joint that is in need of his supplies that happens to be revolutionizing the food industry. Kroc stumbles upon and then subsequently sort of stole this brother's American dream, you might say. So, and these brothers are played by the great Nick Offerman and John Carroll Lynch. They play Richard and Maurice McDonald, whose trendy hamburger stand in San Bernardino, California, won Kroc over with its signature speedy service system and put the fast in fast food and put that type of service on the map. So from the moment that Kroc sees the success of this establishment, all he can think about is his involvement in successfully franchising McDonald's and seeing it evolve in some way or another, which he kind of does and initially helps out, but in ways that are definitely ethically questionable and downright calculating and eventually legally in a very gray area. So it becomes very difficult to see what happens to the rather sincere and optimistic McDonald's brothers, because they wind up getting screwed over more or less. And, you know, the whole just the whole endeavor becomes less about providing the general public with convenience and food and more about real estate dominance. So this was written by Robert D. Siegel, who brought us Big Fan and The Wrestler. And for me, the script and direction just didn't seem to cohesively work together for me. It kind of aspires at times to be a bit like Aaron Sorkin, with its kind of frantic, fast-paced delivery and some rapid editing, but it seems to lack real character or tension building on any kind of dramatic level for me. I found myself more on the outside looking in, despite the fact that there are very good performances from Offerman, John Carroll Lynch, and especially Michael Keaton, which you expect. This is the kind of role that he sinks his teeth into quite well. But the material is presented in what I feel is kind of an uninteresting, rather conventional manner for the most part. So I wasn't as engaged as I hoped to be. But it's certainly watchable and interesting to learn about the history of how fast food began. I'm mostly in the middle on this one, but if you're curious about Keaton or this true story, you could do worse, I suppose. I'm just I'm just in the middle on the founder.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on. We got to take a break here, and then we'll come back and we'll find out what Colin thought of the founder and what I thought of the founder as well. It's the Movie Reviews on a Monday morning. We'll take a break. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning, that's right, Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric Childress is not here for the regular section of the movie reviews because he is in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival, and we will get a live report from him in just a few minutes. Sitting in for him is Jim Laskowski, our good friend, and Colin Suter is here as well. Before the break, Jim told us about the founder and what he thought of it, and let's get back to it. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Colin, what did you think of the founder?
Yeah, I'm kind of with Jim on this, and it's kind of frustrating because I think there's a really interesting story here. It's one we've seen before. It's definitely along the lines of The Social Network, you know, this guy who founded this thing that is, you know, hard to imagine, you know, us not having in America, but he essentially stole it, you know, from two brothers. So there's a lot of parallels there. And it's unfortunate that the screenplay ended up, you know, being directed by John Lee Hancock, who's made some good movies before, but this feels like it's a little outside his wheelhouse. I think he's better off with movies like The Rookie and Saving Mr. Banks, and I guess The Blind Side, even though I don't like that film. But that's more in his that's. This feels like it should have a director who can really get under the screenplay and give it some bite. There are times when I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be looking at Ray Kroc as a hero or as, you know, a flawed human being, because Keaton is giving one kind of performance, but then you got a score by Carter Burwell that's giving me a different kind of sentiment altogether. So it's a movie that's kind of at odds with itself and how it wants to present the life of Ray Kroc. That being said, Keaton is really terrific in it, and the Offerman and
John Carroll Lynch,
yeah, are both really wonderful. And it's a story that I really didn't know. So I like watching it unfold like that. And of course, I get a special kick out of the idea that the movie takes place in my hometown, Arlington Heights, part of it anyway.
Yeah.
But it was filmed in Georgia and New Mexico. So don't get excited, anybody. Anywhere near our state. And it did make me hungry for not McDonald's hamburgers, but the hamburgers that you saw on screen that the two brothers are cooking, which look nothing like McDonald's hamburgers, but they look good. It's certainly an interesting story that I'm glad I was, you know, was told. I just kind of wish there was another director at the helm. But like Jim said, you could certainly do a lot worse. And I'm kind of in the middle on it, too.
Okay, I liked it more than you guys did. I liked it, and I'm recommending it. I agree with you that it is a little bit schizophrenic, and I would have rather had a different director take it on. It's John Lee Hancock is interesting. I mean, the one movie that he made that I think is absolutely great is The Rookie. And I have issues with every other movie the guy's ever directed. I think this is the second best movie he's done, and I think a lot of that has to do with how good the performances are. Michael Keaton is great. Michael Keaton is just the king. He rules. And he's really terrific in this movie. And Offerman and John Carroll Lynch are really wonderful in it and very real. And I cared about what was happening. Now, I wasn't really aware of the whole story. I didn't know that Ray Kroc basically just came in and stole this. And then how do you feel, you know, your last name is McDonald. And, you know, and he keeps the name McDonald's, and you got to drive past the arches every day, you know, and go, oh, boy, that sucks. But it's an interesting American, you know, story about business and how things get done. And I thought that the script itself, it had some problems, but I thought they did a nice job bringing Ray Kroc to life. Like, it was a three-dimensional character, and it was fully realized thanks to Keaton's performance. I think, and again, I think Michael Keaton is just great. And I, you know, and we always talk about how great he is and everything, and he's really, really good. In this movie, he gets to really run with it. Now, I don't, is this his 2016 release?
You know, it's hard to say because I think some critics or groups or some, you know, organizations were able to put Keaton on their best actor nomination list.
Yeah.
But we didn't see it until this year.
Right.
So,
I mean, I don't know if he's, know. I mean, and there's been no buzz at all. I mean, the Oscar nominations are announced Tuesday morning, and there's been like no buzz at all about Michael Keaton, and he's terrific in the movie. And well, I think under any circumstances, he would certainly be nominated.
Yeah, I guess. I think there may have been some, you know, I think maybe the Weinsteins thought, well, you know, this is the Weinsteins, so that's all they think about is a consideration to how much money they should put behind an actor or a film or something. And I think the film itself is just kind of getting so-so reviews while Keaton is getting, you know, the
right
reviews.
Right.
And it's just not a whole, it's not a lot of enthusiasm to mount a whole Oscar campaign around, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's what they're thinking.
Yeah. And I mean, it is, I mean, IMDb lists it as 2016, but I just, because of the lack of year-end praise for Michael Keaton, I was like, what? Because he's really great in the movie. And yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect movie, and it certainly, you know, they're obviously seem to not be as enthusiastic about it as the Weinsteins would, because they push everything.
Right. Yeah.
So it's surprising that they wouldn't take out and they want to get a nomination for Keaton, and you know, because he's been on such a tear lately. You know, he starred in the last two Best Picture winners. So
yeah,
you know?
I guess if you know you're competing against Manchester by the Sea and La La Land, and sort of, you know, Sure Thing
and Fences, Denzel and Fences for sure,
right?
So, yeah, all right. Well, I mean, I liked it more than you guys did. I'm recommending it. I think it's an interesting story. It's not perfect, but the acting I think really pulls it up. And so I'm recommending The Founder. Okay, you guys hang on. All right.
Okay.
All right, we got one more movie to talk about, and that's M. Night Shyamalan's new movie. We got the news, and then afterwards we will review Split right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We are here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and then for your morning drive at 6, the great Steve Cochran for a Monday morning. My dad will call in and tell a joke, because it's Monday and a jokey time. And we also have a great Black Hawks Express. Nice weekend for the Hawks. Really strong weekend of two very exciting, fun games on Friday and last night. So we've got the Express coming up as well. We're going to talk about movies that are beloved but never really made it to number one at the box office. So we're going to talk about that as well. All that and more. Our text and talk is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, we've got one more movie to talk about, and let's get Colin Suter is here with us, and Jim Leskowski filling in for Eric, who is at Sundance, and we'll get a live report from him in just a few minutes from Sundance. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right, so Colin.
Yep.
Tell us about Split.
All right, this is the latest from M. Night Shyamalan, and it tells the story of three teenage girls who get kidnapped by a menacing-looking guy with glasses, played by James McAvoy, who sprays some kind of mace or poison or whatever at them in a car and then takes them to an underground basement somewhere. And they eventually come to realize that this guy assumes multiple identities and has a psychological disorder whereby he has 24 personalities that come and go. And it's we don't see all 24. We see about 5 or 6, I think. It's unclear what he plans to do with these women, but anytime one of them tries to escape, they fail and are put into a different room in this underground, you know, basement or whatever it is. One of the girls, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, has the movie kind of centers on her, of the three girls, and she has flashbacks of going hunting with her father and her uncle that we assume will end up meaning something later on in the film. So the movie goes back and forth in time there.
And during all of this, this kidnapper, James McAvoy, constantly emails his psychologist, played by Betty Buckley, to try and set up, you know, these these sessions that, you know, aren't real appointments. And we see plenty of that so that M. Night can go out of his way to explain the psychology to the audience of what's going on. And I think that's where the movie trips up the most, in that, you know, you with this with the kidnapping story and the girls trying to escape and everything, I think there the movie lacks a lot of suspense and a lot of momentum, because for some reason I think we're supposed to be just scared or nervous about the idea that this guy keeps emailing his psychologist or his psychiatrist. And it just, it kind of undercuts everything. And not once during the film did I feel any sort of suspense or tension from what was going on. I was mostly kind of bored. I don't think the personalities that M. Night wrote for this guy are really interesting. I think they're kind of boring. I think it's, they're kind of, you know, what you'd expect from a thriller of this kind with that kind of character at the center of it. And I think McAvoy does what he can with what he's written. It's not a bad performance, but it's, I wasn't terribly excited about it either. All the stuff with the flashbacks of the girl, I thought added up to nothing. I think this is, you know, M. Night's idea of, you know, a feminist parable, and it falls completely flat. And by the end of this film, I was just kind of like, well, okay, I've given M. Night credit in the past for always hiring the best best cinematographers, the best editors, the best composers. It's just his work, his side of the of everything that just never works. He's not a good writer or director, but he hires the best people to work on his stuff, and their work usually does shine through. But so by the end of the film, I thought, well, it's another case of that. It's just, it's not very good. But then the last shot of the film is where I got really angry, because now I realize, oh, this isn't really a film. It's a director. I won't give it away, but the more I thought about it on the way home, the angrier I got about this film. I hated it. So, yeah, I am not recommending Split. I keep wanting to call it Slice or Splice or whatever. I can never get it right. I'm not recommending Split at all.
Okay. All right, Jim?
I kind of am. you know, M. Night's, he's a weird guy. He's a weird director that I don't despise that much. And maybe it was like, because, you know, for Directors Club, I did an episode on him, and I had to binge on all of his movies.
God.
And I don't know. I warmed up to some of the ridiculousness, and maybe that is kind of on a so bad it's good experience for, you know, some of his other films. But I actually kind of like Unbreakable a bit more than I did in the past. I don't think he's a great director. I don't. And his screenplays have ridiculous dialogue, and of course we all know that he loves a good twist, but even those are just eye-rolling. But in this case, I found myself interested, at least, because, you know, and I can admit my bias, and I have an interest in psychology and films about personality disorders, and I thought McAvoy was excellent in, you know, kind of a showy but really complex, interesting role that, again, becomes a little bit silly. But I thought the film had this interesting thematic element that I wasn't expecting surrounding abuse and sort of drawing power from pain and turning trauma into strength, which is an interesting idea to leave the audience with. But unfortunately, M. Night's got to be M. Night. And like Colin mentioned, that final shot made me laugh out loud in the theater because I just went, oh, man, you had to go there. Because everything else I kind of liked. I liked McAvoy. I liked Anya Taylor-Joy. So I'm giving this one a mild recommendation. I don't think it's a great movie, but, you know, for M. Night, I'm giving this one a pass because I was not as bothered by where the story goes, and I think the performances are quite good. Just don't go in expecting greatness, and you might have a decent time at the movies.
Okay. Hell just froze over because I really like this movie. And I have never liked an M. Night Shyamalan movie. I have not liked any movie he's directed. None of them. I think this is by far the best movie he's directed. And I think a lot of it has to do with Anya Taylor-Joy and James McAvoy, who I think are both great. And I think that this, the Anya Taylor-Joy stuff, I think is really interesting. And I think it builds up to something kind of big, Colin. And I don't know if maybe you saw it coming. But I didn't. And there's no twist in this movie. It's one of the few movies that he's made where there is no, like, oh, that's a huge surprise. Now, let me just say this. Yes, the final shot is absolutely ridiculous, and I hated it, and I laughed out loud. And my parents, who saw the movie with me, were like, what was that? And I had to explain to them what it was. So, that's a given. That is the most M. Night Shyamalan moment in the entire movie. And it's unfortunate that that's the final thing that you see.
It undercuts everything. Even though I don't like I don't agree with you guys on the merits of the film, but I can I wasn't going to walk out angry.
Yeah.
About it, because it just undercuts everything.
Well, I don't agree that it undercuts everything. I think it's just a really self-indulgent and silly moment that
yeah, why it undercuts it.
I don't know. To me, it didn't bother me. I mean, it made me laugh, and I thought it was ridiculous, but it didn't harm my interpretation of the rest of the film. And I think there's a lot here. I think this is a suspenseful movie. There are moments in the movie that I think are creepy and build beautiful suspense. I can't remember who the composer is, but the score is fantastic. The score is terrific.
It is.
And I think it builds up tension really well. It's like a guy who knows how to handle suspense did this. Now there are complete illusions, like the opening credits. And, oh yeah, you saw Psycho. Congratulations. You know what I mean? Like when you're watching the credits at the beginning, and you know, obviously, you know, every movie that he makes, he owes like a gratitude to Hitchcock, obviously.
Raising Kane too.
Yeah, well, Raising Kane is a better movie. There's no question about it. But yeah. I think the two main performances are great. And I want to mention Anya Taylor-Joy because, you know, like, man, McAvoy is obviously getting all the press for this because he's great in it. And I think the characters are interesting. And I think, Colin, I think he does a great job of making them distinct and different. But both physically and just like the way I think he's great in the movie. It is a great performance, and I think it anchors whatever problems I have with it. And it's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. There's a lot of talking about, you know, there's a completely unnecessary scene where Betty Buckley is on Skype, you know, explaining personality disorders. It doesn't need to be there, but it's there, you know. So it's not a perfect movie, but I think, you know, and I thought all the performances were really good, and I thought it was really creepy. And I felt, before that final shot, I felt there was like a really great message about being damaged and what happens to these characters as a result of being damaged. And I thought the fate of the girl was just horribly sad. So the stupid final shot comes up at the end. So anyway, but I'm recommending it. I got to tell you, maybe I'm nuts, but I liked Split, and I thought McAvoy and Anya Taylor-Joy were both really, really terrific in it. So
I feel like tonight that I'm filling in for Eric and Jim is filling in for me. I have no idea who's filling in for me.
All right. Well, next week we've got, are they releasing A Dog's Purpose? Because I know they can't.
Screening it on Tuesday.
They canceled the premiere. I know that much because of all the controversy.
Really?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Well, the screening is still going on for Tuesday. For
all right.
So it's coming out.
It's coming out. That's going to be interesting. And then you've got Gold with Matthew McConaughey, and Resident Evil: The Final Chapter.
Oh God.
Okay.
Yeah. Fantastic.
That is not screening for press.
No. So shocking.
There's that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, Jim. Thanks a lot for filling in.
Happy to, anytime.
The new podcast is Voices and Visions. You can go to voicesvisions.net, voicesvisions.net. And Colin, as always, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. There's Colin, and there's Jim, and we just reviewed all the new movies. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, Eric Childress will be joining us live from Utah. He's at the Sundance Film Festival, and we're going to get reviews of some of the movies that he's seen there. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. 720 WGN. We reviewed all the new movies. We want to thank Jim for sitting in for Eric. And Eric, who is calling in right now, he is in Utah. He is at the Sundance Film Festival, and he's going to see a ton of movies, many of which we will see in the coming weeks and months ahead. And we welcome Eric to the show. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much.
All right. You're at now. How many years have you been going to Sundance now?
This is my 15th year.
Oh my God! Really?
I know. Yeah, you believe that?
Wow, 15 years in a row now.
15 years I've been doing this for you.
Wow. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Now,
you're welcome.
How many movies? Now, when did you get there?
Thursday.
Thursday. And how many movies have you seen?
I've seen 16 movies.
16 movies since Thursday.
Which is a little light because weather has been really bad up here.
Oh, it has.
In the day. So, yeah, and particularly tonight. I got out of my 6 o'clock movie tonight and just walked out, and the wind and the snow was so forceful I couldn't even open my eyes.
Wow.
Walking down the street. So,
wow. You know,
I had to bail on some of the movies tonight.
You know, Saturday was 52 degrees here.
Yeah, I heard.
Okay.
Yeah. There were random strangers on the shuttle. I swear to God, every shuttle I was on yesterday going, it's 60 degrees in Chicago today.
Yeah.
People not even from Chicago saying that.
Yeah.
Like, thanks a lot.
It was ridiculous, man. It was absolutely ridiculous. Okay, well, by the way, I like an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
I saw your post. I was disturbed by your post. As I've been telling people who have been, because I got three emails Tuesday night after the screening from different people, including Colin, telling me how ridiculous Split was, and I got really excited because I love, we all love carrying Shyamalan a new one. So I'm just really excited that I have something ridiculous to look forward to when I get back from Sundance.
Well, I don't
like this.
I will say this, Eric, that Colin and Jim and I all agree, the final shot of the movie is one of the most ridiculous things ever.
Okay,
and it is it is unbelievably ridiculous. Now, for Colin, for him, he hated the final shot so much that he said it undermined the entire rest of the film.
Yeah, he got rivaled.
Yeah, well, no. It's Eric. When you see this final shot, you're gonna fall out of your chair. It's ridiculous, and it's the only moment it's the only moment in the movie that is full on M. Night Shyamalan. For me, the rest of it, including two great performances, because McAvoy, I mean, it goes without saying, he's one of my favorite actors on the planet. He's great in it, and Anya Taylor-Joy from The Witch is terrific in it. And I think I liked it, but again, I fully admit that final shot, Eric. When you see it, text me because it's unbelievable when you see the final shot of the movie. But it still didn't ruin it for me.
First text.
Okay, cool. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about it. You've been you're in Sundance, and it's up to you, man. What do you want to hit us with?
Well, we might as well segue. I saw another Anya Taylor-Joy film here.
Oh,
at
good.
The festival.
Okay.
It's a film called Thoroughbred. It was just picked up by Focus World, actually. So we will be seeing that at some point. And it's Anya Taylor-Joy and Olivia Cooke from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl and Bates Motel.
Oh yeah.
And they play basically sociopathic kind of best friends. there's not a whole lot I can tell you about the plotting of this movie. All I was going to say that both of them are sociopaths in their own way, and the entire movie is essentially about plotting the potential murder of Anya Taylor-Joy's stepdad. And it also stars Anton Yelchin.
Oh, boy.
In one of his final performances, and it might be his best performance, I think. Mm. I think he's really great in this movie. And that's basically the entire crux of the movie. It's, I mean, there's a lot more going on to it, going into it, but obviously I can't say too much or go too much into depth
right.
about it. But I can tell you that it's a debut film. I don't have the director's name handy.
It's, I'm looking at it. It's Corey Finley.
Yes, okay. So
Corey
it's
Finley.
Debut, it's a very incredibly competent debut. It's a film that has a very distinct voice to it. The dialogue really like crackles. The two, I mean, the three, all the performances in the movie are good, but particularly the two lead female performances are really exceptional. I don't think Olivia Cooke has been better in anything either, and Anya Taylor-Joy is great as well. A real kind of nice little surprise gem here at the fest.
All right, Thoroughbred, and that's a good one. So, hey, Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Eric Childress is live from Utah at the Sundance Film Festival with exclusive previews of a bunch of movies that he's seen. And we'll talk more with Eric after we take this break on WGN. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the show. And we reviewed all the new movies already, but Eric Childress is in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival where the weather has been terrible. And it's cut back Eric's screenings a little bit, but he's seen 16 movies so far, and he's telling us about some of the other ones that he's seen. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay. What do you want to go to next?
Well, let's go to the film that's made the big splash at the festival so far, a film that was bought by Amazon, who had a really good year in 2016, and they're starting off in good fashion again with a movie called The Big Sick.
Okay, The Big Sick.
Yeah, and this is it's basically kind of an autobiographical tale of Kumail Nanjiani from Silicon Valley. And he plays himself in the movie, and it's a story of a romance that he had in real life in the movie. She's played by Zoe Kazan. They meet at a comedy club, and they form a really interesting relationship. But as a Pakistani, he is subject to the arranged marriages of his culture. So it's this sort of this back and forth between whether or not he can have a romance with a Caucasian girl and still maintain, a prominent role with his own family.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, the relationship takes a turn when she comes down with sort of a mysterious illness and is hospitalized. And this causes him to sort of force his way a little bit into a commitment by meeting his parents, or her parents, who are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano.
Oh, boy. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty awesome. So a good portion of the movie then becomes him breaking down the relationship and dealing with her parents and whether or not she is actually going to even survive this illness or not. The movie was produced by Judd Apatow, so it feels exactly like a lot of his films of the past. But the response to this movie here has been relatively unanimous in just how much people like in this movie. And it really is one of the best movies I've seen here. It's incredibly funny. Kumail Nanjiani, he hasn't really had a chance to have a lot of range in some of the roles that he's had.
I mean, he's
kind of just playing a version of himself. And here he's playing himself, but he gets bigger scenes, I'll say. And the movie is set in Chicago, where he was living at the time and doing stand up. So Chicago is a big part of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, I mean, I think he's great. Holly Hunter, national treasure. We know this,
of course.
Ray Romano has been doing, I think, some of the most interesting work of his career post Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, from Men of a Certain Age on.
Yeah,
yeah.
And he's great.
Yeah.
In this movie, there are jokes in this movie that were laughed at so loudly by the audience that I saw it with that we missed the next 3-4 jokes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really funny film. Amazon picked it up for $12 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And Michael Showalter directed it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he did.
All right. The Big Sick. All right. Cool. And that, mm-hmm. we will definitely see that one. And Amazon picked it up. So
mm-hmm.
there you go. Okay. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go to The Hero.
Okay.
Which is stars Sam Elliott as a aging old Western movie star who has basically been reduced to doing voiceover works because of his great pipes.
Wow, all right.
Slightly autobiographical type movies. And so in the movie, I mean, he's not playing Sam Elliott. He is playing a character. And at the beginning of the movie, he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And he's also been told that he's requested to be honored by some Western Appreciation Society for a Lifetime Achievement Award. So he has an estranged daughter, an estranged wife. He meets a young woman played by Laura Prepon, who they form sort of a friendship and relationship. His pot dealer is played by Nick Offerman, who was in a Western show that they did together many years ago. He was a boy, and Sam Elliott was older. Basically, what you have here is kind of like The Wrestler, but like extra light.
Okay.
If you will. It really kind of follows the almost the exact template for the Wrestler, right down to the estranged daughter material and how that's handled. Mm-hmm. He's a bit more of a likable character than Mickey Rourke is. You know, he's not quite as flawed, and they don't really kind of explore that too much.
Yeah.
It's not a great screenplay, but it's a showcase for Sam Elliott, who I think in the last 3 years, he's done television work, and he was really terrific in Grandma, which I think is the best thing about that movie.
He was phenomenal in that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is a movie that, like, after that, it's just like someone said, like, you know, someone this guy deserves a showcase. Let me write him a showcase. And it's kind of like the same way that what they did with Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart.
Yeah.
Let's, like, give this guy a chance to win an Oscar kind of role.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what they did here. And it works because of him. Because there are scenes in this movie that are powerful because of him. And I think Offerman's really good in the movie as well. They don't do too much with the female characters. The Laura Prepon character is very underwritten. So is Kristen Ritter plays the daughter. But the scenes between him and Offerman are great, and there are a lot of really great individual moments for Elliott. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but I think you will like it just simply on the strength of Elliott's performance.
Yeah, well, I mean, he rules.
So, yes.
Yeah. All right, so that's The Hero. All right. And you're recommending it?
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. Where do you want to go next?
Let's just go to my favorite movie of the festival, which I saw today. It's the last movie I saw, so I'm still kind of on a high about it. David Lowery, who last year surprised everybody with his remake of Peace Dragon.
Right.
Has reteamed with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, which they did Ain't Them Body Saints together. And they just did a movie that nobody even knew, seemed to know existed until Sundance announced this lineup. And it's a movie called The Ghost Story. And in the movie, Affleck and Mara play a married couple living kind of a house out of the way. And Casey Affleck's character is killed in a car accident. And as he's sitting there in the morgue, the body's identified in the morgue, he sits up. He sits up in the morgue underneath the sheet and then spends the rest of the movie observing Rooney Mara and everything around him underneath the sheet in, like, a classic ghost costume. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, and it sounds like a comedy. It sounds like, you know, something that could be really go wrong if not handled correctly. But this is an absolutely beautiful movie. Leisurely paced, a lot of long takes, but a movie about observing the world around us, about our place in the world, the way that we're sort of like grains of sand in the greater fabric of the world. It's a movie about sadness. You're continuing all the themes from last year, movies about grief. There are images in this movie that are incredibly sad. And yet, just as many images that are incredibly beautiful. It's a movie that plays with time. There's even a little bit of Interstellar sprinkled throughout in the movie, which I thought was kind of interesting. It's a movie that I cannot wait to see again. It's not a movie that everyone's going to respond to the first time. Like I said, if you're you know, forget Pete's Dragon. If you have to be sort of familiar with Anthem Body Saints and some of his previous works to know that this is a guy that's going to take his time, do a lot of long takes, a lot of long shots. I mean, when you watch the movie, you think he might have been able to do the movie in like a week. Mm. That, you know, that's how the movie's constructed. But the way the movie picks up and where this movie goes surprised the heck out of me. By the end of the movie, I was incredibly moved, and I just wanted to talk about this movie with anyone else who had seen it. So this is my favorite movie of Sundance so far.
That you've seen so far, okay. And that's called A Ghost Story. Has it been picked up? Will it get distributed? I mean, you would think, right?
Yeah, A24 actually picked it up before the festival.
Okay, so A24 has got it. And so is Casey Affleck trying to corner the market on sadness now?
I think so. And it's funny, like most of the movie, he's under the sheet.
Yeah.
He's just under the sheet with the two little eye holes. And there are some flashbacks and things like that, but it's mostly him under a sheet.
Okay. All right. So that sounds terrific. David Lowery, really interesting, really good filmmaker. And so looking forward to that. That's called A Ghost Story. So we will definitely get to see that one. All right. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go to one that disappointed.
All right.
One of the bigger disappointments of the fest. Jenny Slate re-teamed with Julian Robespierre. They did Obvious Child together. And they've done a follow-up movie called Landline that's set in the mid-90s. Jenny Slate and her actually plays a younger sister. I think it's Abby Quinn, I think is her name. They find out that their father, played by John Turturro, maybe having an affair. And it's this movie about the best way to sort of describe this movie is that it's sort of atypical, generic Sundance family relationship comedic drama kind of thing.
Yeah.
It has all the standard plot devices for family squabbles and Jenny Slate's in a relationship with Jay Duplass, but might be rather experience the pleasures of Finn Wittrock, whether or not her relationship is that strong. And the actress who plays her sister is really not very good in the film. Edie Falco plays her mom. So it's really kind of on top of everything, it's kind of a really wasted cast. It has a couple laughs throughout the film, but ultimately, if it was not, you know, made by Slate and Robespierre, it would be really dismissed out of school pretty quickly.
Hmm. That's too bad.
It was a big disappointment. It doesn't have any of the voice that we saw in Obvious Child. It's not as consistently funny as what we saw in that, because there was very little that was generic about Obvious Child.
Oh, Obvious Child is a wonderful movie.
It really is.
Yeah.
And this one is just kind of, you know, anyone could have made it.
Okay. And that's Landline.
Yeah.
All right. By the way, have you watched Horace and Pete, speaking of Edie Falco?
No, I have not gotten a chance to watch that.
It's on Hulu.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Yeah.
It's pretty unbelievable, man. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. Hey, Eric, hang on, all right?
All right.
All right, we got a break here for weather and traffic, and we're going to come back and talk more with Eric and wrap it up, the Sundance coverage right here on WGN, and here's your weather. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And Eric Childress is joining us. He is in Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. It's 15th year going to the Sundance Film Festival and giving us exclusive previews of some of these films that he's seen. And let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so where do you want to go next?
Well, let's go to another good one.
All right.
Let's go back to the good pile. And Dee Rees, director from a few years ago, did a movie called Pariah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good movie.
Yeah, really good movie. Yeah. And she has upped her game with a movie called Mudbound.
Okay.
This is a story. It's based on a novel set in sort of like World War II, the South of World War II. Garrett Hedlund and Jason Clarke play brothers. Garrett Hedlund goes off to war. Jason Clarke stays back to sort of man the farm and build a family with Carey Mulligan. And his father, played by Jonathan Banks, who is a severe racist, they in the building of their home and whatnot, they enlist the patriarch of a black family to help them put together the farm, hire them, and whatnot. And it becomes a sort of the story of not just the two brothers, but these two families, the white family and the black family, and who also has a son played by Jason Mitchell, who played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's from Keanu as well.
Yes, he
gets the key. Yeah, he's the one who goes, oh, in Keanu. So
well, he's got a lot more to do in this.
No, I understand. I know. Yeah. But that little moment in Keanu has become like a catchphrase here on the show.
Oh, okay.
We do a lot of, oh, on the show, and it's inspired got by it. Him. Okay, so, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so it becomes, you know, the story of these two families, the two brothers, but also about the two men who go to war. So there's a lot of different things going on here. A movie that could very easily get out of control under the hands of a less skilled director. A lot of characters, all of whom pretty much get an equal share of time to develop their characters. There's very few people in this movie, if at all, who are underdeveloped. I think all the performances are really strong. Garrett Hedlund, who's been spotty in the past, I think does maybe the best work of his career here. Jason Mitchell is fantastic in this movie. There's a lot of things going on, war and racism and families, and again, another movie that sort of plays with time and catching up to things. This is a really confident piece of work from her. And you know, Pariah was a small little film, got quite a bit of recognition, film festival circuit some years ago. And like I said, this is the kind of thing you expect from a director who's maybe been around the bend a few times. But this is a significant leap in her career. And all the movies that have premiered so far, there's only been these few that I've really been mentioned have been sort of the standouts so far. This is the first one, probably the top one where people are talking potential Oscar consideration for next year.
Okay. And that's called Mudbound.
Yes.
Yes, Mudbound. Okay, great. Sounds great. All right, where are you going next?
Let's go to a film called Walking Out.
Okay.
I'm got kind of a sucker for survival stories. I always like movies where people go off into the woods and then have to fight their way out. Your Revenants, your At the Edge, movies like that.
Yeah.
And this is a story of Matt Bomer, and I don't have the young actor's name who plays his son in the movie. It's the boy from Hellion from a few years ago with Aaron Paul.
Alex Neudstetter.
Yes. So the son comes out to his sort of cabin in the wilderness. Matt Bomer plays his father, and he's going to take him out for his first big hunting kill. They're going to try to hunt a moose, and so they go off in this pretty much is like this 5 mile trek into the wilderness. A lot of teaching him about hunting and the sort of the breakdown of what it's like, what it means to be a hunter, and all these things. Flashbacks to his own childhood when he first learned. His father's played by Bill Pullman, and something occurs while they're out there, forcing them to basically walk their way back out under extreme circumstances. Again, I don't want to spoil exactly what happens, but if you were a fan of survival stories, of like the ones that I've mentioned, this is a very strong one. Again, a very sort of confidently told story that, works also obviously as a father-son story between the two, which obviously clearly I'm a sucker for.
Right.
And it's just, the cinematography is gorgeous. It's suspenseful in parts. It's beautiful in parts. I really just responded to this movie in one of the better examples of these types of movies. I think this is a really strong film with two really solid performances.
That's great. So that's called Walking Out, and we're going to get to see this one.
I hope so. I don't think it's been picked up yet, so we'll see that at some point. Okay. I imagine we will.
Okay. So that's called Walking Out. All right. Well, listen. Tell everybody now. You are tweeting. You're covering this. You know. So if people want to follow you on Twitter, how are they going to do that?
Eric the Movie Man. It's Eric with a K. And I'll also be posting. I'll be updating my Letterboxd list, so they'll be on Facebook. If you find me on Facebook, I'll that list will be updated daily as well, with all the movies I see.
All right, the Letterboxd, and that's without an E, Letterboxd without an E.
Yes.
All right, cool. Right. All right, Eric, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it.
As always.
Take care, man. There you go. All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up right here on 720 WGN.